Composer Giacchino Rossini, next to whose grave in Paris Patti requested to be buried, and the children who died of TB there when the castle was used as a hospital between 1922 and 1986. The person most haunted by Berlioz's symphonic setting of Romeo and Juliet, on the other hand, was Richard Wagner, who used it as a stylistic template for his opera Tristan und Isolde in 1865. Berlioz's temperament was, to be sure, suited to the fascinations of 19th-century opera, doomed love, death and destiny, even if it was not so well suited to the patient, collaborative process of putting on operas. His operatic Everest was the epic, lyrical tragedy Les Troyennes, the Trojans, a sumptuously passionate retelling of the fall of Troy and the suicidal liaison between Trojan hero Aeneas and the queen of Carthage, Dido. The actual affair may not have lasted as long as the opera itself, its incredible 5.5-hour length being one of the many obstacles to its being mounted in its entirety during Berlioz's lifetime. It was eventually performed whole for the first time in 1921, 52 years after his death. In between revolutions, communes, epidemics and wars, Paris was the Vegas of the 19th century, and the grandeur of its opera production stood at the pinnacle of a glittering high society scene. Opera composers from all over Europe were drawn to its glitz and glamour, and the prospect of getting rich from musical tragedy. Luigi Cherubini was one such composer, born in Florence, but able to flourish in Paris by tiptoeing deftly between opposing camps as political power changed hands before, during and after the revolution. In all, he produced 18 operas there, including some that, daringly, had a topically political flavour, such as Les Deux Journées ou Le Porteur d'Eau, which was a thinly veiled reimagining of a contemporary political controversy. He was followed to Paris by Gaspar Spontini, favourite of the Empress Josephine, whose La Vestale, the Vestal Virgin of 1807, was the best received of his 8 Parisian premieres. Italian-born Giacchino Rossini, already famous, moved to Paris in 1824 and presented 5 operas there, including William Tell. Giacomo Meyerbeer and Jacques Offenbach, the nom de plume, in fact, of 2 German Jews originally named Jacob, took the Paris opera world by storm in the 1830s and 40s. Meyerbeer's grand spectacles, particularly Robert le Diable, 1831, Les Huguenots, 1836, and Le Prophète, 1849, turned him into a wealthy and much-decorated celebrity. They were the most regularly performed new operas in the world during the 19th century. Offenbach, meanwhile, composed no fewer than 98 operettas in Paris before his death in 1880, some of which, like Orpheus in the Underworld, La Belle Hélène and La Vie Parisienne, were outrageously popular, even among the not-so-well-off. Notwithstanding the universal admiration for Offenbach's comic operettas, the opulence of the Parisian experience of opera and its position in society still meant it was a luxury. But the relationship between opera and the populace could not have been more different in Italy, where opera was a popular art form. By popular, I don't mean some people quite liked it. I mean almost all city dwellers would have known the songs from the latest operas. If you lived in Turin or Milan or Naples in 1850, opera was your iTunes or your TV. This seems strange to us, aware as we are that even subsidised seats in modern-day opera houses cost upwards of 100 quid. But in 19th-century Italy, opera was entertainment. In his immaculately researched study of music and its audiences, The Triumph of Music, Tim Blanning sums up the scale of Italian operaphilia and the pivotal role of it in every community thus. The opera house often included not just a stage and auditorium, but also cafes, restaurants, gambling casinos and public spaces where people could just meet and socialise. Many people went 4 or 5 times a week. Nowhere else in Europe and at no other time in European history has so much opera been performed as in Italy between 1815 and 1860. In Milan, there were 6 theatres in which opera was performed regularly. In Naples, there were 5, plus 1 more occasional venue. Opera was the soul of the Italian people as well as its chief off-duty pastime. The hummable operas of three composers, Rossini, Donizetti and Bellini, dominated the first half of the 19th century, but no one captured the hearts of all Italians more completely than Giuseppe Verdi, whose first hit was Nabucco in 1842. He reigned supreme for half a century, and his early offerings, Nabucco included, had plots carefully chosen to whip up the Italian people's desire for self-government, the movement known as the Risorgimento. Thanks to this, Verdi became a political as well as a cultural icon. Like his crowd-pleasing predecessor, Donizetti, Verdi's first dozen or so operas were concerned mostly with giving the audience a series of show-stopping solos and choruses hung on a stirring plot from history or legend, generally involving heroism, self-sacrifice, defiance of neighbouring powers, bandits, brigands, highwaymen, and dastardly villains. They were not so very different from Hollywood movies of the 1930s to 60s. Battles were big, especially if they involved bullies being trounced by minnows. So Peruvian tribespeople standing up to the Spanish conquistadors, Alzira in 1845, lowly Joan of Arc against the brutish English, Giovanna d'Arco, 1845, or plucky Lombards taking on all comers, I Lombardi alla prima crociata, 1843, La Battaglia di Legnano, 1849, were typical. But then, in around 1850, Verdi's approach changed gear. Whether he sensed his audiences were hungry for something different, or the impulse came from his own shifting priorities, the result was a direction of attention to more contemporary issues and plotlines, even those that were ostensibly set in the past. This new attitude, at least initially, scandalised as much as it excited. Stifalio, first performed in Trieste in November 1850, provoked official condemnation and substantial censoring, telling as it does the tale of a married Protestant minister learning to forgive his adulterous wife. It was based on a play that had been published only the previous year and was set in recent times rather than in the safely distant past. His next project, Rigoletto, was also based on a recent banned play by Victor Hugo, Le Roi s'amuse, which lampooned an immoral, corrupt king. Hugo had had Louis-Philippe I, last king of France, in mind, and accordingly encountered further difficulties with the authorities, in this case Venetian, who insisted scenes be removed and the period and setting be changed. A tragic melodrama of fate and revenge, Il Trovatore, followed in January 1853, immediately becoming one of the most popular operas in history. But even this did not prepare Verdi's now thronging admirers for the shock of La Traviata, which was put in front of an astonished public just 3 months later in Venice. La Traviata is about a doomed love affair and parental interference in a young couple's unlikely liaison, once again echoing Romeo and Juliet, climaxing in the agonising and symbolic death from TB of the once promiscuous female protagonist, Violetta. The opera's title translates approximately as The Woman Who Went Astray, though a modern colloquial translation might be The Slut. Based on a recently published bestseller, The Lady of the Camellias by Alexandre Dumas, La Traviata was met at first with moral outrage. To death and destiny, Verdi had now added sex. The Venetian authorities demanded that the opera's present-day setting be put back 150 years to reduce its potential to shock, while Queen Victoria was advised not to attend the London premiere 3 years later for fear of being seen to endorse its immorality. But though its birth was controversial, La Traviata eventually swept nearly all before it. To date, there have been over 20 film adaptations, and it's the second most performed opera of all time, after Mozart's The Magic Flute. Of course, stories like The Lady of the Camellias allowed 19th century audiences to have their cake and eat it, to enjoy being spectators of what they thought of as lewd behaviour, and then to have their hypocritical morals endorsed by seeing the naughty woman who indulged in it die a horrible death. Violetta doesn't expire, mind, before she's broken the audience's defenceless hearts with an adieu of choking beauty, the aria Addio del passato bei sogni ridenti, farewell, lovely, happy dreams of the past. It's no coincidence that the figure of the fallen woman stalks through so many operas, novels and paintings of the second half of the 19th century. With increased male middle-class spending power came astonishing levels of prostitution. Social historian Judith Welkowitz calculated in her authoritative Prostitution and Victorian Society, 1980, that 19th century industrialised cities had on average a staggering ratio of one prostitute per 12 adult males. La Traviata confronts this sexual hypocrisy, that every woman had her price and yet should be condemned for it. The death of Violetta was meant to strike shame into Verdi's audience's hearts, as it did the meddling father of her lover in the final scene. It was a bold attempt to change prevailing social attitudes by a man who was second only to Garibaldi, hero of the struggle for Italian independence, in fame. And Verdi understood that opera was at its most powerful when attempting to impart universal truths through emotionally engaging morality fables. By making his fellow countrymen and women confront their double standards, their prejudices and insecurities, through his accessible, sweeping melodramas, he arguably did do as much to better the lives and self-esteem of Italians in the 19th century as Garibaldi. Throughout his gloriously successful career of 28 operas, Verdi managed to convey emotions, stories and often layered concepts of deeply felt intensity without disappearing into a private world of musical complexity that only other musicians could appreciate, an alarmingly common tendency that crept into opera as the decades rolled on. His tunes were firmly rooted in an easy-to-grasp, enchanting-to-sing Italian vocal style, so that ordinary folk really could leave the theatre humming. Those who couldn't afford a ticket need not have missed out either. Barrel organists and other itinerant musicians would hang around the theatres, learn the tunes, and make a living busking them in the street the next day. So solid was the foundation Verdi created for populist Italian opera that even when, in the early 20th century, classical music became convulsed in turmoil and discord, he was able to hand over seamlessly to composers like Leoncavallo and Mascagni. But without doubt, Verdi's greatest successor was Puccini, whose death and destiny-heavy masterpieces belonged to the mindset of the 19th century, even though they were written at the turn of the 20th, their generously melodic melodramas bucking the trend of modernism. In all art, there are few more poignant critiques of the abuse of power than Puccini's Tosca of 1900, or of rapacious imperialism than Madama Butterfly of 1904, both of which were presented, then as now, as mass-market commodities without pretension or snobbery. If it had been left to the Italians, classical music would have made it to the modern age without so much as a scratch, still completely mainstream, still loved by everyone. As late as 1936, La Scala in Milan could still premiere such enthusiastically received comedies as Ermanno Wolf-Ferrari's delightfully tuneful and quaint Il Campiello, based on a play written for the Venetian Carnival of 1756, and which would not have been stylistically out of place had it opened a whole century earlier, rather than in the same year as the BBC began television transmissions. North of the Alps, though, things have been developing very differently indeed. If instrumental and symphonic music of the first half of the 19th century was totally dominated by Beethoven, music in the second half belonged to a French-speaking Hungarian born in what is now Austria, Franz Liszt. What's odd about this statement is that virtually everyone has heard of Beethoven and can probably recall some piece of music by him, but very few can name a piece by Liszt, even if they've heard of him. He was a genius other composers slavishly followed for well over half a century, yet to most modern listeners he's just a name, alongside his colleague Brahms. But Liszt was a trailblazer, an experimenter, a pace-setter. To do justice to the increased obsession with death and destiny, someone needed to turbocharge music's engine. Liszt was that man. Disturbing emotions were conjured up in Liszt's harmonies. Flashy set pieces thrilled and terrified a sensation-seeking public. Liszt, Mr. Trick or Treat, was the composer who, more than anyone else in the mid-19th century, recalibrated music's forces, so it's worth looking in detail at some of the many innovations he brought to fruition. First, he kick-started a craze for extravagant Halloween-style music, full of dark, deep, crashingly loud chords and abrasive strings. It's a craze that has yet to abate. His Theatre of the Macabre, as seen in his scary Totentanz, Death Dance of 1849, for solo, piano and orchestra, didn't inspire just composers of his own period, like Saint-Saëns' Danse Macabre, 1874, or Grieg's March of the Trolls, 1891, or Liadov's Baba Yaga, 1904, but also film composers of our own time, including the chillingly ingenious Danny Elfman. Elfman's Lystian score for Tim Burton's 1989 Batman, for example, gives edge-of-the-seat action sequences an undercurrent of avenging menace. Second, Liszt was a spectacular pianist who more or less single-handedly, or indeed two-handedly, forced piano builders to adopt iron frames to replace wood ones because they simply broke under the hammering he gave them on stage. His use of the piano as a fairground of effects bedazzled audiences at his live concerts. One of his party piece showstoppers was a grand chromatic gallop, composed in 1838, which can be seen as the template for Offenbach's hallmark can-cans of 20 years later, for example the Gallop Infernal from Orpheus in the Underworld. Showy, circus-like turns, though, were only a tiny part of what he could do at the piano in his recitals, a term he coined for a solo piano concert. In his 30s, Liszt became music's first international star, embarking on a merry-go-round of European tours, where he was known and treated as the King of the Piano. According to contemporary reports, some female fans became hysterical at the mere sight of him on stage. This aspect of his celebrity was, I fear, rather overhyped in the late 20th century, in an attempt by classical record companies to make him more relevant to a younger generation in the pop era. Although the term Listomania was first used in 1844 by the German writer Heinrich Heine in his review of a series of recitals in Berlin, the 1975 film by Ken Russell, Listomania, unsubtly likened the adoration of Liszt's female fans to the phenomenon of Beatlemania and subsequent similar manias. Ever since the film, a lazy identification of Liszt as the first rock star has developed. Granted, he inspired unprecedented levels of dedicated fandom for his day, but a few anecdotes about female concertgoers swooning or hoping to take away some memento from a live Liszt appearance, a handkerchief or, in one report, a discarded cigar, hardly measures up to the Fab Four arriving in a helicopter to perform at the open-air Shea Stadium in August 1965 in front of 55,600 screaming, weeping, fainting fans whose noise deafened the hundreds of NYPD officers deployed to protect the artists and totally overwhelmed the stadium's PA system. Liszt's third innovation was his perfection of a keyboard style that shimmered and gleamed, an aural equivalent of the blurred vibrancy of an oil painting by Monet, where sounds melted and smudged into one another like colours. This technique in music has since been described as impressionistic, and specifically attached to the works of the French composer Claude Debussy, whose pieces had visually evocative titles such as Reflections in the Water, Footprints in the Snow, The Hills of Anna Capri, and Gardens in the Rain. Debussy's Gardens in the Rain, though, was composed in 1903, a good 30 years after the Impressionist painters had first begun exhibiting their works to a disconcerted Parisian public. If the term impressionistic belongs to anyone, it's not Debussy, who disliked the comparison between the movement in art and his music, but Liszt, whose Fountains of the Villa d'Este, for example, dates from 1877, just 3 years after the first Impressionist exhibition. This was a piece that was well known to the young Debussy, who revered Liszt as a disciple and who was honoured to be able to play for him in person in 1888. Liszt's fourth innovation was in the field of orchestral music. He invented what he called the symphonic poem and wrote 13 of them, templates of a form that was to be taken up enthusiastically by composers as varied as the Czechs Bedřich Smetana, Antonín Dvořák and Leos Janáček, Russians Mili Balakirev, Modest Mussorgsky, Alexander Borodin, Nikolai Rimsky-Korsakov, Alexander Glazunov and Anatoly Liadov, Germany's Richard Strauss and Finland's Jan Sibelius. The idea behind Liszt's symphonic poems was to reduce the traditional four-movement symphony, as exemplified by Beethoven, into one concentrated, shorter piece that would be a musical response to a non-musical artwork. His subjects ranged from Prometheus, mythical hero of ancient Greece and muse of Beethoven et al., to Shakespeare's Hamlet, from Orpheus in the underworld to a contemporary painting of a battle in AD 451 between Attila the Hun, the Visigoths and the Roman Empire. While Beethoven had framed his sonata-form pastoral symphony around visual images, a walk in the country, a thunderstorm, peasants merrymaking, he was more interested in his own feelings than in the pictorial effect of his scenes. Liszt's symphonic poems, on the other hand, were a departure from this trend in that they intended to conjure up in music the pictures or the stories themselves. Liszt was moving away from the idea of music as an abstract entity, something to be listened to attentively for 40 or so minutes, towards orchestral music as a representation of something extra-musical. In its purest form, the symphonic poem style is what orchestral film music grew out of in the 1920s and 30s, its job to support and describe something outside music. Though old-style, four-movement symphonies continued to be written even until the mid-20th century, lots of composers leapt enthusiastically on Liszt's symphonic poem alternative. Beethoven's Third Symphony, Eroica, had had at its core an idea, heroism, and its betrayal, but it nonetheless retained the musical form of a symphony. Much the same can be said about Mendelssohn's Hebrides Overture of 1830. It may have had a guiding thought, a holiday visit to those islands, in particular Fingal's Cave, but its form was still determined by a musical template. Liszt's Tasso, Lamento e Trionfo, however, followed the path of an actual period in the life of the 16th century Italian poet Torquato Tasso, to the extent of weaving in a traditional gondolier's folk song to evoke Tasso's relationship with Venice, and creating an anguished first section in the mental asylum where Tasso, possibly suffering from schizophrenia, was for a while imprisoned. The form of the piece, crucially, was dictated by the story. This was a new emphasis for purely orchestral music. Opera, of course, had been shaped by story and characterisation for many years. Liszt's own comments about Tasso, which was completed in 1849 and revised in 1851 and 1854, reveal how specific his approach to telling the tale was intended to be. Tasso loved and suffered at Ferrara. He was avenged at Rome and even today lives in the popular songs of Venice. These three moments are inseparable from his immortal fame. To reproduce them in music, we first conjured up the great shade as he wanders through the lagoons of Venice, even today. Then his countenance appeared to us lofty and melancholy as he gazes at the festivities at Ferrara, where he created his masterworks. And finally, we followed him to Rome, the eternal city, which crowned him with fame and thus pays him tribute both as martyr and as poet. This shift in emphasis, spearheaded by Liszt from purely orchestral to more illustrative music, is particularly notable in his symphonic poem Hunnenschlacht, the one devoted to the 1850 painting of Attila the Hun's battle by Wilhelm von Kaulbach. Fought in AD 451 against the now Christian Roman Empire and their allies, the encounter was a rare occasion on which Attila and his heathen Huns were beaten. At the beginning of the piece, Liszt's music is meant to depict the ghostly armies of the battle mustering for the fight. It's marked to be played tempestuously. And to recreate the effect of the painting's spirit soldiers in the sky, the strings are instructed to play with their mutes on, thus dampening and thinning the sound. Interspersed among the lively, whispery strings are little military outbursts from the horns. In the painting, there are relatively few actual soldiers depicted, the emphasis being more on the ordinary men and women engulfed unwittingly in the conflict. So Liszt is careful not to make his orchestra too percussive and martial, at least near the opening. Eventually, the battle proper kicks off, and, in the midst of the tumult and chaos, Liszt introduces on trombones an old plainsong chant, Crux Fidelis, cross of faith, to represent the caped figure in one corner of the painting who carries a gleaming golden cross. This is followed by a triumphant fanfare and then the introduction of a gentle, holy organ. The plain song theme is carefully interwoven into increasingly agitated string activity in the final 3 minutes or so, giving a general sense of the great victory about to be celebrated, which, when it is, leaves you in no doubt whatever of the scale and meaning of the Roman Christian forces of civilization coming out on top. The muscular victory music is topped off with extra offstage brass reinforcements and an instruction regarding the organ. Dans le cas où l'harmonium ne serait pas assez puissant pour couvrir l'orchestre à la fin, n'en faire aucun usage, which translates roughly as, if it can't be louder than the whole orchestra, don't bother. The final climax is the kind of heavyweight flourish you've heard in countless Hollywood adventure film scores, from Elmer Bernstein's Parting of the Red Sea in The Ten Commandments, 1956, to Hans Zimmer's body-shaking battle music for Gladiator, 2000. Liszt's fifth innovation was a product of the particular political geography into which he was born. The small town of his birth, Dobrogen, then in the Kingdom of Hungary, now Raiding in Austria, was populated by a mixture of Magyar Hungarians and German-speaking Austrians, all of whom were absorbed into the Austrian, later Austro-Hungarian, Empire under the Habsburg monarchy. By the 19th century, many of the majority ethnic Magyars in Hungary were dejected by their lack of self-government, though Liszt himself was far from the turmoil for most of his life. As a child, his musical ability had quickly been spotted, and he was soon in Vienna receiving training from, among others, Salieri, and encountering both Beethoven and Schubert. As an adolescent, after his father's death, Liszt and his mother moved to Paris, where he adopted French as his first language. For the rest of his life, he was thoroughly cosmopolitan, travelling widely, living for 20 years in Weimar and for 6 years near Rome, where he took holy orders. A recent centenary conference and festival devoted to him in modern Hungary simply described him, correctly, as European. But even though he wasn't brought up in Hungary, Liszt held on to some vestiges of Hungarian patriotism beneath his pan-European facade. In 1839, he returned to his homeland for the first time since his childhood and was greeted rapturously by crowds chanting, "Hail, Franz Liszt!" He ostentatiously wore national costume as a gesture of solidarity with the Magyar cause and defiantly performed in public his piano arrangement of the popular but banned Rákóczi March, honouring Prince Francis Rákóczi, who had led a revolt against Austrian domination between 1703 and 1711. In an emotional speech at Hungary's National Theatre in January 1840, Liszt declared his support for his countrymen's aspirations for independence. It is this same sympathy with the country of his birth that is reflected in Liszt's set of 11 piano arrangements of folk songs, the Magyar Dalok, which includes the Rákóczi March, compiled in 1839-40, and his 19 Hungarian rhapsodies for solo piano, composed on and off between 1846 and 1885. That they were intended to have a patriotic as well as a nostalgic purpose is clear from his dedication of the most famous of the set, number 2, composed in 1847, to the Hungarian nationalist, revolutionary and statesman Count László Teleki. Teleki's association with the Hungarian uprising against Austrian rule in March 1848, a revolt that was crushed by imperial armies and followed by a punitive policy of Germanisation, led to him being sentenced to death. Liszt's musical identification with the folk song and dances of his native Hungary was, alongside Chopin's polonaises and mazurkas, the first wave of a movement that was to sweep through music over the ensuing half-century, given powerful momentum by the fact that so many of Liszt's contemporaries, Brahms, Grieg, Joachim Raff, Smetana, Tchaikovsky, César Cui and Rimsky-Korsakov, to name just a handful, were enthralled to him and his every move. The formula that Liszt put to use in his Hungarian rhapsodies, and which was much imitated thereafter, was simple enough. It started with a stately, meandering, slightly exotic first section, known as a lassan or lassù, which was paired with a frantic second section called the Frischka, from the German word frisch, meaning brisk. The third important component of the collection and of all subsequent spin-offs was the ultra-vigorous Sardas dance, which had much impressed Liszt when he was treated to a private recital in May 1846 by the Jewish father of the Tsardas, Mark Rosawolki. Rosawolki's background was poor, and he was most likely introduced as a child to the Eastern European Jewish folk music known as klezmer, and as a young man he travelled through Hungary, Slovakia and Romania, picking up the local folk dances on his violin. Later he became a well-known musical figure in Budapest. Some of his melodies, either newly composed or collected by him, that is, were integrated into Liszt's Hungarian Rhapsodies. Liszt didn't claim the melodies were his, merely that he was arranging them for piano in his own style. But Liszt, like the other composers of his time, was more than a little confused about what indigenous Hungarian music actually was, believing it to be the same as gypsy music, which in turn was often muddled up with Turkish music. In reality, gypsy, Romani music, was in fact quite distinct from Turkish folk music, and also quite distinct, as it happened, from Hungarian, Magyar folk music. For the well-to-do Viennese of the late 18th century onwards, however, including composers like Haydn and Mozart, using the terms gypsy, Hungarian or Turkish was like saying random foreign music by poor people. Indeed, we now know that Liszt and his contemporaries were quite wrong about the provenance of what they called gypsy music. The music they all thought was gypsy was in fact either Hungarian folk music played by lautari, professional Romani musicians, in Budapest and Vienna for the benefit of restaurant or cafe patrons, or it was gypsy-style pastiche, based not on old anonymous folk songs and dances, but on tunes from popular stage shows or drawing-room ballads, their original composers' names wittingly or unwittingly lost over time. They have since mostly been identified. The real Romani of 19th century Central Europe, whose fundamental ethnic origins were Indian, kept their own music to themselves. Liszt thought, though, that Hungarian folk music was gypsy music, and the publication of his first book of Hungarian Rhapsodies in 1853, in a generic folkloric style dressed up for the sophisticated Western European salon, prompted a craze that virtually all composers in Europe emulated. Some plundered their own country's rustic folk dances, some opportunistically arranged the folk music of other countries, while others dipped into the non-specific well of travelling gypsy band music. This boom has subsequently been labelled musical nationalism, but I find this terminology problematic. The flaw in describing it as nationalist is that while it was sometimes identified with political movements seeking self-determination, as in the case of Liszt's Hungarian Rhapsodies or Sibelius's Finlandia, in other cases it was merely an excuse for inserting ethnic idioms and sounds into salon or concert hall music with no national or political motivation whatever. Or, at best, a confused motivation, as with Liszt's well-intentioned misunderstanding of Romani music. Likewise, the magpie-like composers of the 19th century sometimes even made use of such material from regions that were not their own, or, as members of the imperial ruling class, found inspiration in the music of subjugated tribes and communities within their empire's domain, in which cases the term nationalist is surely highly inappropriate. We will encounter examples of all these variants. To be clear, the phenomenon of repackaging ethnic music may in many cases have been motivated by a deep and sincere love of country and of the traditions and roots of peoples who felt oppressed by other more powerful nations, no doubt about it. But what it was not was a bottom-up, grassroots movement whereby peasant troubadours presented the treasures of their communities to the world. In all cases, the movement that used to be called nationalism in music was concocted by highly trained, sophisticated, well-travelled, middle-class composers, mostly trained in Leipzig, Vienna or Paris, who took bits and pieces of folk song and dance that they'd heard, probably in city taverns, not even in the rural heartland, and whipped them up into what were essentially mainstream Austro-German musical caricatures for the amusement of an audience who had no interest in the genuine struggles of peasant culture at all. Among the most popular collections of the type that Liszt's example engendered were Johannes Brahms's Hungarian Dances of 1869 and 1880, which exploit all the usual folksy dance forms of Lassan, Friska and Czardas. Brahms, who was more than a little in awe of Liszt's talent and status, but found his music too progressive to enjoy, was a self-confessed musical conservative, following in the more formal tradition of Beethoven, Schubert and his friend Schumann. And though his unsheltered boyhood was partly scarred by piano playing in seedy bars and brothels near the Hamburg docks, his familiarity with genuine Hungarian folk music would have been wholly second, if not third, hand. His Hungarian Dances are great fun and highly polished, but, make no mistake, if you'd played one of them to a passing Magyar milkmaid on the banks of Lake Balaton in 1870 and asked her what it was, she would have likely answered, "Nice, some kind of fancy German music." The integration of pseudo-peasant style into the piano and orchestral mainstream was an unstoppable flood, yielding many of the best-loved gems of 19th-century music, from the Bohemian, Czech, composer Dvořák's Slavonic Dances of 1878 and 1886, to Finnish composer Sibelius's Karelia Suite of 1893, from Bohemian, Czech, Smetana's Mavlast, My Country, of 1879, to Hugo Alfvén's Swedish Rhapsody, Midsommarvaka, Midsummer Vigil, of 1903. Popular Czardas dances were pastiche by Frenchman Delibes in his ballet Coppelia of 1870, Russian Tchaikovsky in his ballet Swan Lake of 1877, and perhaps best known of them all, Italian Vittorio Monti, whose Czardas of 1904 was later adopted by genuine Romani Lautari bands and orchestras across Europe to play to their foot-tapping clientele. What goes around comes around. Liszt himself wrote three piano Czardas between 1881 and 1884, including, naturally, a Czardas Macabre. Nowhere were the moral questions surrounding the borrowing of elements from ethnic music and putting them into mainstream music more sharply highlighted than in the United States, where one composer in particular found himself at the centre of a highly divisive debate. Middle-class Americans of the late 19th century were keen not to be outdone by their European counterparts, so they built concert halls, established orchestras, and invited star names across the Atlantic to perform. Antonin Dvořák, by the late 1880s, already well known outside his homeland, especially in Britain, was invited to New York by a wealthy philanthropist in 1892 to become director of the new National Conservatory of Music, at 25 times the salary he'd been paid to do the same in Prague. He lived in New York for 3 years, producing, among other things, his now extremely familiar Ninth Symphony, From the New World, in 1894. Dvořák's clear and oft-stated aim at the college, published in newspaper articles shortly after his arrival, was to encourage young American composers to adopt and develop the melodies of Native American and African American communities in their orchestral music, as he and his Bohemian students had done with Czech and Slavic folk music back in Prague. He wrote, "I am now satisfied that the future music of this country must be founded upon what are called the Negro melodies. This must be the real foundation of any serious and original school of composition to be developed in the United States. These beautiful and varied themes are the product of the soil. These are the folk songs of America, and your composers must turn to them. In the Negro melodies of America, I discover all that is needed for a great and noble school of music. They are pathetic, tender, passionate, melancholy, solemn, religious, bold, merry, gay, or what you will. It is music that suits itself to any mood or purpose. There is nothing in the whole range of composition that cannot be supplied with themes from this source." Dvořák's optimism was as much scoffed at as admired, and his comments about Negro music made front-page news on both sides of the Atlantic. Italian composer Puccini remarked a few years later, "There is no such thing as American music. What they have is Negro music, which is almost the savagery of sound. Added to European snobbery was white American scepticism about Dvorak's public statements. Bostonian composer Edward McDowell, who himself had trained in Paris and Frankfurt rather than America, and who mostly wrote German-style music, responded, "We have here in America been offered a pattern for an American national music costume by the Bohemian Dvorak, though what Negro melodies have to do with Americanism in art still remains a mystery." Nonetheless, McDowell's own mother, Frances, did provide a scholarship for a young African-American musician, Harry Thacker Burley, to join Dvorak's classes at the National Conservatory of Music, where he introduced the Bohemian composer to spirituals and assisted him with orchestral part copying. Burley arranged some of these spirituals, published in 1901 as Six Plantation Melodies for Violin and Piano, and later had considerable success with song arrangements of spirituals and the composition of sentimental ballads, including Little Mother of Mine, 1917, Dear Old Pal of Mine, and Under a Blazing Star, 1918. Of Dvorak's other students, Reuben Goldmark responded to his call to arms with a setting of Longfellow's Hiawatha, and in 1923, 1 year before the premiere of his own pupil George Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue, a Negro Rhapsody. Dvorak's other notable student, organist and composer Harry Rowe Shelley, may not have heeded the call as conscientiously. Certainly not if his orchestral works Souvenir de Baden-Baden and The Crusaders are anything to go by. But if Dvorak's teaching methods raised eyebrows among his adopted countrymen, his own American compositions were to prove even more controversial. His New World Symphony of 1894, in particular, was scrutinised for the extent to which it was actually American, the original source of its melodies, and whether it was even Dvorak's right to appropriate folk music styles, if not actual melodies, of another community for his composition. One very vocal opponent of the tide of ethnic imitation was the writer, civil rights activist, and co-founder of the National Association for the Advancement of Coloured People, W.E.B. Du Bois. He was at pains to point out in The Conservation of Races, 1897, and in his seminal essay collection The Souls of Black Folk, 1903, that the slave sorrow songs of the plantations were not, as Dvorak would have it, a national resource open to all Americans. Rather, they were quite specifically the voice of the oppressed African-American. These songs are the articulate message of the slave to the world, and should remain so. He described having heard the sorrow songs as a child, including Swing Low, Sweet Chariot, which he called the cradle song of death, recalling that they came out of the South unknown to me, one by one, and yet at once I knew them as of me and of mine. This was primitive African music, the voice of exile. For Du Bois, the Negro people of America had to resist absorption into white America. Their destiny is not a servile imitation of Anglo-Saxon culture, but a stalwart originality which shall unswervingly follow Negro ideals. We are the first fruits of this new nation, the harbinger of that black tomorrow, which is yet destined to soften the whiteness of the Teutonic today. We are that people whose subtle sense of song has given America its only American music, its only American fairy tales, its only touch of pathos and humour amid its mad, money-getting plutocracy. One of the New World Symphony's greatest controversies concerns its slow movement, still instantly recognisable thanks to its innocently memorable tune, rather like a hymn, and also because it was subsequently co-opted for a bread commercial in which it evoked rural Edwardian England, which fact in itself should alert us to the dangers of music's ability to reinforce national characteristics. Its similarity to a hymn tune was spotted not long after its premiere at Carnegie Hall in December 1893, since it was given holy words and turned into a sacred song, Goin' Home, by another of Dvorak's pupils, William Arms Fisher. Persistent claims have been made that Dvorak heard the tune from Harry Burley, a theory proposed, for example, in a 1922 letter written by the composer Victor Herbert. Dr. Dvorak was most kind and unaffected and took great interest in his pupils, one of which, Harry Burley, had the privilege of giving the doctor some of the thematic material for his symphony. I have seen this denied, but it is true. Burley himself later wrote, I gave him what I knew of Negro songs. No one called them spirituals then, and he wrote some of my tunes, my people's music, into the New World Symphony. Another claim was made for African-American guitarist W. Phillips Dabney, who suggested it was based on his own plantation melody Uncle Remus, which he'd played to Dvorak in his conservatory office and, he reported, copied down onto manuscript. The tune has often been compared to the spiritual Deep River, while another of the symphony's melodies has been likened to Swing Low, Sweet Chariot. Dvorak certainly intended his symphony's skipping rhythms and melodic shapes, derived from the five pentatonic notes we've encountered before, the black notes on a keyboard, those common to all the world's music cultures, to sound like those of Native American peoples. Even before his arrival in America, he had read a musicological essay published in Germany in 1882 called On the Music of the North American Indians. He stressed, though, with regard to the symphony, I have not actually used any of the Native American melodies. I have simply written original themes embodying the peculiarities of the Indian music and, using these as subjects, have developed them with all the resources of modern rhythms, counterpoint and orchestral colour. Further stimulus for inquiry regarding Dvorak's sources for the tunes in the New World Symphony were prompted by his admission that he had previously been developing ideas for a musical setting of Henry Wadsworth Longfellow's epic poem, loosely based on Indian tribal legends, The Song of Hiawatha. Dvorak abandoned the Hiawatha project but claimed to have absorbed research he'd conducted for it into his musical thinking for the symphony. Without definitive documentary evidence of particular sources, we may never know if this research included tribal melodies he later passed off as his own. By far and away, the period's most successful setting of Longfellow's poem was the Song of Hiawatha, an oratorio trilogy completed in 1900 by English mixed-race composer Samuel Coleridge Taylor. The hugely oversubscribed premiere of its first instalment, Hiawatha's Wedding Feast, in November 1898 at the Royal College of Music, was described by the composer Sir Hubert Parry as one of the most remarkable events in modern English musical history. Just as Longfellow's intention in writing the poem was not colonial exploitation, but rather an attempt to portray the Native American tribespeople as noble savages, with much in their folklore to value and enjoy, so Dvorak's aim in composing his symphony was to raise the aspirations of American music makers and music lovers. He wanted them to have pride in their own heritage, not to see it as a second-rate imitation of European culture. The irony, of course, was, as Leonard Bernstein pointed out in a blow-by-blow analysis of the symphony in 1956, that in his well-meaning but superficial imitation of primitive Native American and African American melody types, Dvorak's style also sounded like that of other non-mainstream cultures. These included Chinese and Scottish, as well as some Eastern European ethnic folk music. Dvorak himself acknowledged that irony, saying in a newspaper interview, "I found that the music of the Negroes and of the Indians was practically identical," going on to affirm that the music of the two races bore a remarkable similarity to the music of Scotland. James Huneker, reviewing the first performance of the symphony, identified the Swing Low, Sweet Chariot theme in the first movement, describing it as Negro or Oriental, just as you choose. All of which brings us to the question of whether it's legitimate to plunder the musical content of another community's cultural inheritance, placing it in an alien and artificial milieu for the benefit of a very different audience. Why did it matter whether Dvorak's source melodies for the symphony were borrowed from Native American and African American folk songs, or whether they were newly composed? It mattered because Dvorak's New World Symphony has to be seen in the context of the period. American territorial expansion in the 19th century had repeatedly been justified by a firm belief in manifest destiny, the notion that white Americans had a God-given right, or even duty, to colonise the whole continent. Time and again, though, Manifest Destiny was revealed as little more than a euphemism for the violent appropriation of Native American land for the benefit of white settlers. Would survivors and relatives of the Lakota Sioux Indians butchered at the Wounded Knee Massacre, which took place just 3 years before the symphony's first performance, have recognised its melodies as theirs? If they had, would they not have seen it as yet another form of theft? Even Dvorak, champion of African-American musical advancement, 150 of his 600 students at the National Conservatory were black, a startling statistic of integration in a deeply segregated age, was able to dismiss some Native American culture as all but worthless. "I have heard black singers in Haiti for hours, and as a rule, their songs are not unlike the monotonous and crude chantings of the Sioux tribes." The moral debate as to whether it is ethical for a richer people to adapt the music of a poorer people for their musical entertainment, often uncredited and unpaid, has never gone away and is just as hotly debated in our own time, not least in the fields of blues, jazz and world music. We will meet it again in the next chapter. But for the time being, at the end of the 19th century, there was another great controversy on the horizon. Indeed, any unease generated by Dvorak's relationship with the culture of oppressed peoples was a walk in the park compared to the hornet's nest provoked by Liszt's most needy and argumentative disciple of them all, Richard Wagner. The Colossus of Wagner is an inescapable reality of late 19th century music, indeed of recent Western civilization. He is both brilliant and problematical, and it's fair to say that his towering legacy has had more impact on the worlds of literature, philosophy and politics than, strictly speaking, on musical development. This is because his style was so particular, his agenda so ambitious, and his stature as a German national figure so all-embracing that other composers found it impossible, or unpalatable, to follow his example. Of Liszt's many gifts to the musical world, arguably his most significant is what he mostly unintentionally taught this man, who would eventually become his son-in-law. Wagner's debt to Liszt is so great, in fact, that it's fair to say there is no innovation, no technique, no supposed great leap forward in expression or style anywhere in Wagner's monumental output that is not found somewhere first in Liszt. Sometimes, as in the final movement of Liszt's Dante symphony, Purgatorio, composed in 1856, it is as if whole passages have found their way, doubtless subliminally, into Wagner's texture, in that case Tristan und Isolde. Elsewhere, the gifts are technical. Take Wagner's dismantling of harmony. One of Wagner's favourite tricks was to take the building block of all Western harmony, the common triad, and either squash it slightly to make a diminished chord, or enlarge it slightly to make an augmented chord. Diminishing or augmenting chords does strange things to the way they behave. They become unstable and have a tendency to unsettle the mood because they deviate from comfortable convention, seeking relationships with unfamiliar chords. They are music's drifters and grifters. They create a sense of nervousness, of anxiety and uncertainty. Wagner uses them prolifically throughout his 10 most famous operas to evoke pain or anguish, or to tell you something grim might be about to happen. In the first part of his epic Ring Cycle, the Rheingold, for example, angry diminished chords are often used to signify the dangerous power of the ring itself. Diminishing and augmenting chords Wagner may have made his own, but they are all over Liszt's daring, dark harmony. His Faust Symphony of 1855 begins with an anguished opening theme entirely made up of augmented chords, followed not long after by an outbreak of demonic pain, punched out in a series of very loud, diminished chords. Liszt's Faust is not just noteworthy for presaging Wagner. Its opening theme, albeit not instantly hummable, consists of 12 notes. It uses all 12 notes of the Western scale without repeating any of them. So what, you may ask? Well, When the Austrian composer Arnold Schoenberg proposed a new form of musical organisation, whereby a melody was obliged to use each of the 12 notes of the Western scale in a sequence before being allowed to repeat any of them, a method known as 12-tone serialism, it threatened to bring about the collapse of musical civilization as we know it. We shall encounter it later. The remarkable thing is that Liszt's experiment with the same idea predated Schoenberg by 68 years. Wagner's debt to Liszt is evident even in Wagner's most famous chord, so famous, in fact, that it has its own name. Whole books have been written about it, and academics have built careers on it. It is called the Tristan chord. The Tristan chord comes from Wagner's opera, Tristan und Isolde, and while it has been accorded the kind of mystique and reverence usually reserved for Newton's first law or Einstein's special theory of relativity, it is, when all is said and done, wait for it, a diminished chord. It has been credited, the humble Tristan chord, with signalling the end of 400 years of order in Western harmony and the beginning of modernity. A bold claim, to say the least, and even bolder considering Liszt had been using this chord and many others of its ilk for years before Wagner wrote it into the opening phrase of Tristan und Isolde sometime between 1857 and 1859. Notwithstanding Wagner's debt to Liszt, it would be churlish not to stress that the greatest composers have always tended to synthesise the styles and currents of their time, that they were not necessarily innovators, and Wagner's music, in any case, has far better tunes than Liszt's. Tristan und Isolde is an out-and-out masterpiece with sweeping, yearning themes deserving of its place in music's pantheon, whatever it may or may not have innovated. As a musical experience, it is luxuriant and overwhelming and has the two greatest build-ups to a climax in all music, only one of which is consummated, as it were, the first veers off at the last moment. What it is not, though, is the one thing that Wagner most wanted to bring to the world, musical drama. Clara Wieck Schumann saw the opera in Munich in 1875, and her summary says it all. During the entire second act, the two of them sleep and sing. Through the entire last act, for fully 40 minutes, Tristan dies. They call that dramatic. Like Verdi's La Traviata 12 years earlier, Tristan is about a doomed love affair, death and destiny, of course. The relative inertia of Tristan's plot, with so little action taking place over nearly 6 hours in the theatre, makes it closer in form to an extended symphonic poem with singing than even Wagner's other operas. It's the most extreme example in his catalogue of another striking hallmark of his style. It is not Italian. For a good part of the 18th and all of the 19th century, the populist, light, tuneful Italian style of opera was what most people went to an opera house for. Italian style in opera was completely dominant. So much so that even an Austrian composer like Mozart should really be seen, stylistically, as a German-speaking Italian. All but one of his famous operas is literally Italian, from The Marriage of Figaro and Così fan tutte to La Clemenza di Tito and Don Giovanni. The exception is his German singing play, The Magic Flute. The other centre of operatic style in the 19th century was Paris, though French opera at the time was essentially a grander version of Italian opera. Wagner did not fit either of these moulds. Indeed, one of the reasons musicians from all over Europe flocked to hear Wagner's music dramas at Bayreuth in the 1870s was because they were so radically out of step with the mainstream. Acknowledging or not his debt to Liszt, Wagner's sound was, to them, incredibly daring and original. The essence of that originality was to take what composers normally did in symphonies, long, abstract streams of pure instrumental music, and turn it into a sung drama on stage. Even the idea of attempting this was bracingly novel. Despite the fact that Wagner had learnt his trade writing pseudo-Italian operas, by the time he reached his maturity, he had moved decisively and deliberately away from an Italian style. Instead of a series of clearly defined solos, called arias, narrative prose-like singing that carried the plot, called arioso, Duets and sweeping choruses with a bit of ballet thrown in, as was the Italian way, Wagner preferred a continuous musical flow with all those elements mixed in together. Thus, an Italian opera typically was a series of well-defined numbers, a glorified variety show with something for everyone and plenty of opportunity for lead singers to have their turn at impressing the audience. A showy solo in an Italian opera might elicit spontaneous applause and even encores. Such a reaction at a Wagner performance would have been considered blasphemous, to dare to interrupt the master's unstoppable narrative flow. For Wagner, nothing was allowed to distract from the unfolding musical story, and he would happily intertwine chorus, solo, duets, instrumental interludes, so that you could hardly tell when one ended and another began. The other bonus of this approach, as far as he was concerned, was that it treated the symphony, not other operas, as a structural starting point. Whereas opera in his lifetime was dominated by Italians and Frenchmen, the symphony was still considered the quintessential German form, the Austrians being honorary Germans in his and many others' minds. In his many hundreds of pamphlets, articles, books, and letters, Wagner's contempt for the French was second only to his hatred of the Jews, seeing both as a threat to Germany's destiny, which was to lead Europe and impose an ethnically cleansed culture upon it. Inventing a uniquely German form of opera, therefore, for Wagner, was a political choice. A nationalistic approach also began informing his choice of subject matter, especially after the Germans defeated the French in the Franco-Prussian War of 1870-71. Wagner aimed to honour a resurgent German Reich, and he seized the moment to sell the idea, in his next batch of operas, of an invincible race of Aryan superheroes put to the test against various human or supernatural foes. Some of his operas even reinvented Germany's medieval past. In Tannhäuser, Lohengrin and the Master Singers of Nuremberg, he reworked ancient legend fables so that his contemporaries would be uplifted by the chivalric pride inherent in the tales. The cod historic world of these operas is one in which Teutonic moral strength is associated with poetry and lusty singing, of which there is an enormous amount, Wagner being a stranger to the notion of musical restraint. This wasn't a unique experiment, though, and nor was patriotic heroism confined to music. Over the North Sea in Britain's Victorian Empire, artists, writers and composers were dredging Albion's Arthurian roots, too. The pre-Raphaelite group of painters were particularly fond of their St. George's, Sir Galahad's and Ladies of the Lake in spotless glistening armour or see-through negligees, as captured, for example, in Edward Burne-Jones's Sir Galahad, 1858, St. George and the Dragon, 1868, and The Last Sleep of Arthur, 1881-8, Emma Sand's Elaine, 1865, John Everett Millais' The Knight Errant, 1870, John William Waterhouse's The Lady of Shalott, 1888, Dante Gabriel Rossetti's Sir Launcelot in the Queen's Chamber, 1857, and Before the Battle, 1858, and the model in that picture, artist Elizabeth Siddal's The Lady of Shalott, 1853, and The Quest of the Holy Grail, or Sir Galahad at the Shrine of the Holy Grail, 1857. The unprecedented international popularity of historical fiction